Russian attacks near Kyiv a day after its flagship in the Black Sea sinks.
Reportedly, there were 3 missile shots on Kyiv. 2 of them have been shut down by the air defense. And apparently, third one actually reached the destination.
Plus, the head of the World Food Program paints a bleak picture of the situation in Mariupol.
We can't reach the people. We have demanded that we be given the access. We have not been given the access. We will continue to do everything we can to reach those people.
And later in the program, the story of a pair of musicians whose friendship transcends the war. Today is Friday, April 15th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Kyiv was hit Friday by some of the most powerful explosions heard since Russian forces withdrew from the area 2 weeks ago. A day after Moscow suffered a stinging symbolic defeat with the loss of its flagship in the Black Sea, Russia's defense ministry promised on Friday to ramp up missile attacks on the Ukrainian capital in response to Ukraine's alleged military diversions on the Russian territory. The threat of intensified attacks in Kyiv comes after Russian authorities accused Ukraine of launching airstrikes on residential buildings in Bryansk, a region that borders Ukraine, which reportedly wounded 7 people. Authorities in another border region of Russia also reported Ukrainian shelling on Thursday. Earlier today, I caught up with reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv to learn more.
Around 1:30 in the morning, there were 3 blasts heard in the city of Kyiv and in the Kyiv region as well. Reportedly, there were 3 missile shots on Kyiv. 2 of them have been shut down by the air defense. And apparently, third one actually reached the destination. So we don't have official comments yet from the government. But what we know from the AFP information agency and from the civilians who live in the area, apparently one of the missiles reached the plant, which is reportedly produced the Neptune missiles, which struck the Moskva warship. So it was an attack on a specific place and a specific plant, which is located just next to Kyiv.
And I also want to ask you about things in Kyiv, because in the past few days, there have been reports by the United Nations that more and more people are returning to the capital. And France has announced that it is going to repopulate its embassy in the capital, moving back from Lviv, where it had been at the onset of the war. What can you tell us about the mood in the city, as there are widespread predictions that as Russia redistributes its forces from the capital region to the Donbass, that fighting could pick up soon?
Kyiv is actually coming back to life, and you can feel it. If 1 week ago you go around in the city and there is no cars, no people, now things have changed a lot, and there are actually traffic jams already. So a lot of people have already returned, despite various information and despite what the local government is saying and asking to wait. But the thing is that you cannot really find an absolutely safe place now in Ukraine. And of course, if Kyiv is your home, Kyiv is not a super risky place at the moment. At least this is what a feeling that you have right now. The mood in the city is very positive. People are ready to, you know, renew the economy. People are ready to work, and a lot of businesses are back and working again. I should say that city, you know, is trying to do its best despite the war. But of course, you feel the war. Of course, you feel that it could be attack, it could be missile attack, and you have a lot of air sirens going on. But anyway, it is quite normal for the moment.
Anna Chernikova reporting from Kyiv, Ukraine. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The head of the United Nations World Food Program, David Beasley, speaking to the AP, said people are being starved to death in the besieged Ukrainian city of Mariupol. He also predicted that the country's humanitarian crisis is likely to worsen as Russia intensifies its assault in the coming weeks.
I don't know of anything that's happening good inside Mariupol. We can't reach the people. We have demanded that we be given the access. We have not been given the access. We will continue to do everything we can to reach those people, and we'll keep fighting for them. That's all we can do. And we will not give up on the people in Mariupol and other people that we cannot reach. But it's a devastating situation.
Russian forces that control access to the city have not allowed aid in, even though, as Beasley said, the WFP has demanded access. Russia is determined to seize the city so its forces from the annexed Crimean Peninsula can fully link up with troops elsewhere in the eastern Donbas region, Ukraine's industrial heartland, and the target of the coming offensive. The WFP is trying to get food supplies now into the areas that could be caught up in the fighting as the situation rapidly evolves.
Well, I mean, what's happening now is devastating the people in Ukraine. And obviously, we believe that we can help the people in Ukraine if we are given the access we need. But I don't see any of that easing up. I just don't see it happening right now. In fact, it's getting worse and worse, concentrated in certain areas, and the front lines are going to be moving. And how do we pre-position to help food and anticipation? There's a lot of complexities here.
The WFP executive director also warned that Russia's invasion of grain-exporting Ukraine risks destabilizing nations far from its shores and could trigger waves of migrants seeking better lives elsewhere. Russia and Ukraine together produce about 30% of the world's wheat supply and export about three-quarters of the world's sunflower seed oil. Half of the grain the WFP buys for distribution around the world comes from Ukraine. Beasley says that some 30 million tons of grain bound for export are unable to be shipped because of the war. More than 150 Russian journalists have left the country since its invasion of Ukraine. More are working with international organizations safeguarding the rights of journalists. Anna Rice narrates this story about how the international community is helping independent Russian journalists in these difficult times.
Journalists were among the stream of Russians leaving the country after Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th. For independent journalists, Russia has become unsafe because of a de facto law declaring as fake any information that contradicts the defense ministry. Spreading such information can lead to a prison sentence of up to 15 years.
The honest, independent journalism is the most important thing right now. Only real journalism can effectively fight propaganda. Almost all the independent journalists are enemies of the state now. Why? And the answer is very simple, because the journalism makes a difference in Russia, still makes a difference in Russia. And the Kremlin is really and deeply afraid of journalists.
Guys, stay with us. We won't let you down. We just need a little bit of time.
Journalists at TV Rain, Echo of Moscow and Novaya Gazeta have left Russia when their outlets were forced to stop work in the country. Some of these journalists are getting help from international groups.
So what we're trying to do now is to offer support for journalists who have had to leave Russia, who are still trying to report, and offering what we can do, grants.
The NGO, Reporters Without Borders, is working with the blocked Russian language media outlets, as well as independent journalists whose online platforms have been forced to shut, by creating mirror websites to provide access to the censored information.
We've used our mirror site technology, Collateral Freedom, to unblock Medusa, for example, the most popular Russian independent news website. Most of the work we do in Russia right now with journalists or with media is not always advertised for security reasons.
Reporters Without Borders has also created a fund for Russian journalists to help them leave Russia and work from a safe place. It is also compiling a list for the urgent relocation of about 100 journalists to EU countries. Meanwhile, Russian journalists outside of Russia are urging the international community to help their counterparts still in the country. Anything from grants to special refugee status counts. Arizona immigration attorney Natalia Paluchtin says if Russian journalists can find an employer in the U.S., they can relocate on a special visa.
It's not too difficult to get it. If the person in question really works in journalism, there are various options for him or her, including something connected with university lectures or other socio-political activities.
Many who have lost hope in getting an American visa have headed to the U.S.-Mexican border.
These people get to the entry checkpoint, say the magical words political asylum, and they are taken in. It's still not a walk on a beach, mind you. It's a serious challenge people are willing to face.
Experts believe independent journalists are not likely to return to Russia anytime soon. For now, they just need a chance to work freely and without fear. For Anusha Vitasyan in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The Biden administration appears set to discuss the international economic impact of the Russian invasion and potentially Ukraine's reconstruction as part of the November G20 summit agenda, a plan likely to create further rifts in the economic forum. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara is up next.
As the war rages on in Ukraine, President Joe Biden wants Russia removed from the group of 20 largest economies and for the invasion's fallout to be included on the G20 summit agenda, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told VOA.
It is not uncommon for events that are impacting the global community, as Ukraine is, and the Russian invasion of Ukraine, to play a central role at international forum. And their economic recovery and rebuilding and reconstruction is going to be something that the global community is going to be involved in and address.
This puts Indonesian President Joko Widodo, this year's G20 chair and host of the November summit in Bali, in a bind. He and other middle power members have their own agenda. Dina Praptoraharja, co-founder of the Jakarta-based think tank Synergy Policies, via Skype.
President Widodo's desire is to make sure that the G20 mandate can be upheld. Making sure that as a representative of the emerging economies, the agenda of recovery from pandemic, including the prices of energy, basic prices of goods, can be affordable for all.
Following its 2014 annexation of Crimea, Moscow was kicked out of the group of eight leading industrial nations, now known as the G7. However, it's unlikely Russia will be removed from the G20, a much wider grouping with more competing interests and no formal mechanism to expel a member. So far, Russian President Vladimir Putin intends to attend the summit with Beijing support. Gregory B. Poling, Center for Strategic and International Studies, via Skype.
President Biden isn't going to be in the room with them. I imagine Prime Minister Trudeau won't, several of the Europeans won't, which puts Jakarta in a very tough position here, because are they willing to trade Putin's attendance for having five or six others not come?
Ambassador Dian Triansahjani, a G20 co-sherpa, told VOA that Indonesia will listen to members' views while maintaining G20's role as an economic cooperation forum. Responding to criticism that Western demands to exclude Moscow disrupt the summit's agenda and create division, Psaki said that Putin has shown himself to be a pariah in the world and has no place at international forums. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Sanctions have been used for decades, but how compelling have they been at bringing about change? VOA's Michelle Quinn takes a look at the sanctions against Russia and other nations in recent history.
Russia is facing economic sanctions over its invasion of Ukraine from dozens of countries. The sanctions target a vast range of sectors. They also target individuals, including Russian President Vladimir Putin himself, his two adult daughters, as well as high-level government officials and leading Russian businessmen. The sanctions have cut Russian banks out of a key financial messaging system and frozen the assets of Russia's central bank. Russian aircraft cannot take off from, fly over, or land in dozens of countries. The U.S. has banned oil and natural gas imports from Russia, while many European countries have announced plans to scale back the use of Russian energy. Import bans affect dozens of other Russian products, spanning industrial goods to high-end items. The U.S. has suspended normal trade relations with Russia, while European countries are taking similar measures. The effectiveness of sanctions is hotly debated, with both proponents and opponents citing specific cases. Proponents say sanctions helped bring Iran to the negotiating table in 2015 and to agree to limit its nuclear activities. In South Africa, decades of international sanctions played a role in ending that country's apartheid government in 1990. The use of sanctions became prominent following World War I as countries sought ways to avoid the horrors of another world war. U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt used an oil embargo in 1940 to successfully persuade Spain to remain neutral during World War II. However, just 1 year later, Roosevelt cut off Japan's ability to buy U.S. oil, with drastically different results. Japan, soon afterward, bombed Pearl Harbor and increased its military assault throughout Asia. Part of its objective was to acquire more oil. An economic blockade of Nazi Germany also failed to deter the plans of Adolf Hitler. Moreover, the German leader cited concerns about sanctions as a reason for his territorial conquest. A study looking at more than 170 case studies spanning a century of economic measures found sanctions were at least partially successful only about a third of the time. Failures cited by the study include Cuba, where decades of U.S. sanctions have not led to the fall of the communist government, and North Korea, which has not given up its nuclear program in the face of international sanctions. The PIIE study found that sanctions are most successful when a country's goals are modest, such as the release of political prisoners. They are much less successful when seeking regime change and democratization. And they are the least successful when trying to stop a military operation. The sanctions against Russia have caused the ruble to swing in value and inflation in the country to rise. Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin acknowledged in April the situation is the most difficult in three decades for Russia. However, the sanctions have not so far stopped Moscow's military operation. Russia's foreign minister said in March that Russia would adjust its economy to the sanctions and that they would make the country stronger.
VOA's Michelle Quinn. The World Trade Organization also reported this week the war in Ukraine has dealt a severe blow to the global economy, shattering expectations of a recovery from the damaging impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on world trade and business confidence. Lisa Schlein continues our coverage.
The Russia-Ukraine conflict has cast a pall over the global economy. This has prompted World Trade Organization economists to downgrade their forecast for world trade over the next 2 years. They now expect world merchandise trade to grow by 3% this year and pick up slightly to 3.2% in 2023. This is down from the previous 4.7% projection. They say these figures are likely to be revised again given the uncertainty from the fallout of the war in Ukraine. WTO Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala says the economic reverberations of this conflict extend far beyond Ukraine's borders.
It's now clear that the double whammy of the pandemic and the war has disrupted supply chains, increased inflationary pressures, and lowered expectations for output and trade growth. These events and the enormous uncertainty they have created make for a complex forecasting environment.
The WTO finds the most immediate economic impact of the war has been a sharp rise in the price of food, energy, fertilizer, and some important minerals. Okonjo-Iweala notes Russia and Ukraine are key suppliers of these commodities in the world market. She warns a potential food crisis is looming. She notes poor countries are likely to suffer most from high food prices because they tend to spend a large portion of their income on food.
Low-income food deficit countries saw their food bill rise 20% in 2021, an increase of $120 billion. 35 African countries import food from Ukraine, Russia, or both. The problem of high food prices is compounded by high fuel prices, and expensive fertilizer represents a threat to future crop yields.
Egypt and Tunisia import about 80% of their wheat from Ukraine and Russia. Other countries such as Lebanon and Haiti also depend heavily upon wheat imports from these countries. The World Food Program warns the ongoing war in Ukraine will increase global hunger. Ukraine is due to harvest its winter crop in July and plant next season's crop in September. WTO Director General Okonjo-Iweala says it is crucial that farmers be allowed to cultivate and harvest their wheat crops to lessen a food crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And finally, a friendship between a pair of Ukrainian and Russian musicians is transcending the fighting that's taking place between their two countries. Jacopo Luzzi rounds us out this week.
I just decided one day when I was 9 years old that I'm going to become a cellist, and this was the coolest thing I could do with my life.
31-year-old Valeria Sholokova is from Ukraine. She moved to the U.S. 20 years ago, but she still has her homeland in her heart.
And there's nothing like watching your home burn down. I felt horrible for the next few days, just shattered, and everything hurt. I mean, it was grief.
Sholokova still has her father, relatives, and friends in Ukraine. She says the images from Ukraine make her cry every day. But in the middle of her torment, a friend reached out.
He reached out to me first. It was a very genuine, touching message, just saying that, you know, that he's heartbroken and that he's with and he feels my grief.
Nikita Morozov is a 35-year-old Russian violinist. He grew up in Montreal, Canada, and often performs with Sholokova. They have been friends since they met at the Juilliard School in New York City more than a decade ago.
I love playing with Nikita, and playing with Nikita reminds me the best of what music is about, and it's mostly a feeling of connection and feeling like you're on the same wave as somebody.
I think it's really important to use discernment and to find, you know, what is the source of the problem, which is Putin. And it is not the Russians, because there are so many Russians who are against this war.
The bond with Morozov is helping Sholokov deal with this moment. And to her, it's completely relevant that he's from Russia.
Well, I think it's humanity above all else. I mean, I've never seen Nikita as a Russian violinist, and I've never seen myself necessarily as a Ukrainian cellist, and I think it's mutual.
For Valeria, music is what helps her to get through the day.
Let's take a minute of silence. Thank you. This is the only thing that takes my mind off of my grief right now. There are two things, is being with people and playing music.
That's why Morozov feels like he must take care of Sholokova more than ever. Something he says everybody should do now with all the Ukrainians around the world.
I think, you know, when we go through something difficult and we're there for each other, bonds are made and connections are made, and they're much stronger because you go through something extremely difficult together. And you're there for each other, and definitely the friendship becomes stronger.
A music-based friendship that transcends the war between countries. Jacopo Luzzi, VOA News, Washington.
And that'll do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage on Ukraine and news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of our entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.